Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the eminent Dr. Mattai Joseph, internationally renowned executive, researcher, and technology advisor, distinguished computer scientist. Mattai, you have such an incredible long history of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for coming in today to share your considerable expertise and deep accumulated insights with our audience.
It's a great pleasure to talk to you, Stephen. I've read quite a lot about you and what you've been doing with the CIPS. It was a great pleasure meeting you in Vancouver just a few weeks ago. And, of course, the experience I had listening to the podcast you made with some very, very distinguished computer scientists is quite impressive.
Well, I can tell you that our audience is just going to be thrilled to have you here today to talk about your insights and all the wisdom that you have, because you've done a lot. You just have an incredible history. And in fact, I encourage the audience, once the podcast is released, to actually look at the background notes and especially the little sort of profile or synopsis you provided. It was just amazing. It's just a very good read as well. So it would be fascinating then to get an insider's look at one of the most significant contributors today. Can you please profile a month in your busy life?
Well, Stephen, I've retired from my active operational role, so it's a little hard to talk about a typical month. My activities now are very varied. Each one goes through a different peak at a different time, and quite a lot of my time is also spent in deciding which of the many things I could be doing are really going to be interesting in the future. And once I've chosen a few, I spend quite a long time collecting information, checking it, seeing whether others feel that the information is correct and suitably representative, and finally getting started with doing some actual work. So this is for the new things I'm attempting today, but I still work with one or two research groups at the research center I headed until my retirement, and there are fairly frequent review meetings. I keep in touch with the group working on using formal techniques such as model checking to verify designs for embedded software and to provide automated checking of program code. I've been working especially with a group investigating technologies for cheap water purification, for removing natural contaminants such as arsenic and fluoride, which are both fairly widespread in India, in water. And I'm closely involved with ACM and with setting up the ACM India Council. We have a lot of plans for how ACM can provide a focus and a forum for teachers, students, professionals. All that is missing today. I think ACM can help us to enrich the whole learning process for computing. But the activity that occupies most of my time now, this is really my day job, if you like, is planning for a big new campus for Tata Consultancy Services, for whom I used to work and for whom I'm still an advisor. This campus is at a site just outside Pune, where I live. So I've been working for the last 2 years with architects, engineers, designers, not to mention accountants, because they're the ones who are going to have to pay for it eventually. And our aim has been to see if we can create a workplace for over 20,000 employees that will provide an exciting environment that is also energy efficient and low cost. The construction has just started. And for me, since I'm really an outsider in this business, I find it truly inspiring to see concrete being poured into shapes that existed only on paper just a short while back. This is what architects do every day, but they tell me that they also share in the excitement of seeing their work take shape. So that's pretty much what happens during a typical month. There's some amount of travel, like this trip, for example, and the one before that to Vancouver, but not a great deal these days.
You know, Mattai, you have this amazing background, as I indicated earlier, and I directed the audience to have a look at some of the profile that you did. Can you outline your prior roles and some key lessons from each of these roles?
You know, Stephen, when I think about it, I'm surprised anyone paid me to do a job because I spent all my time learning. But let me tell you what how I started. When I finished my PhD in the UK, I went back to India, and I started as a research scientist at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in what was then Bombay. Today it's called Mumbai. This was in the late 60s. And that's when I became interested in programming and software systems, mostly by reading about different techniques, and then building small systems, and then building bigger systems, and some of them really quite large by the standards of the day. That's also where I learned that very little of the effort of building a software system is actually worth talking about to anyone else about. It's the little 10% that is experimental and maybe new, perhaps just could be of interest to a few people. And then only if it succeeds in doing something really new. And then I learned that when you're writing about systems like this, even that 10% is fairly boring. If you're lucky, there's about 1 or 2% about the system that others may wish to read about. Equally, of course, what one read in those days and what one reads today from reports of other such systems and other such software investigations is only about the 1 to 2% of the systems that they felt was worth writing about. That's always something to bear in mind. These systems that seem wonderfully glamorous and very, very effective, you're reading about a very small part of the system. The rest of it is the mundane stuff that really has to be done to get anything to work. Now, I was working in India, typically thousands of miles away from other groups doing similar work, and this was a few decades before the internet was created. So reading and writing papers mattered a great deal. There was no easy means of communication. The cost of travel abroad meant that one did not go to a conference more than, say, once in 2 years or 3 years. It's a little hard to imagine today, but the limitations of working under those conditions made us all very much more self-sufficient. We learned to read a great deal at a time when colleagues in the West told me that they'd begun to read less and less because they were getting overwhelmed with the large amount of material that even then, this is the 70s, say, was coming their way. Someone from a U.S. university told me, and I was very impressed at the time, that he never actually read anything without having a graduate student read it first and talk to him about it. And then if he felt it was worthwhile, he wouldn't go and read it. In contrast, I think we, in India, we read everything that made its way to us. Everything could be important. We didn't know, so we had to read it and find out. I think at this institute, which is really an institute of physics and mathematics, one of the important realizations I had was that computer science needs to define itself as a science, not just as a theory accompanied by a large set of practical and engineering techniques. That was very true in the 60s, where there was some wonderful theory coming up. There was complexity theory that was just taking shape. The theory about proving properties of programs was also beginning to take shape around that time. But far away from that, people were building extravagantly large systems, doing all sorts of interesting things. And it wasn't clear exactly what relationship these two things had with each other. Now, the institute I worked was mainly for mainly for physics and mathematics. And these are well-established subjects, and any questions about their science should be easy to answer. But even there, when one looked at what people were doing, say people doing experiments, you began to wonder whether this is really the way science needs to be done. When you do an experiment and it produces a vast amount of data, and then you have teams of people working in shifts, trawling about for possibly interesting phenomena in the observations, you wonder whether this is really science. And that kind of question, I think, matters even more in computing. So one could perhaps restate this question of how do you define computer science as a science by saying, when you do something, will this work be of long-term value? And one then begins to feel that there may be answers coming that are relevant. For example, really important work finds repeated citation in new results and new research, while there's other work that may have seemed really exciting at the time and which failed to attract any attention today. It could, of course, be that there is there was exciting work that was done and it changed the way that we did things, and so we no longer think about the old way in which things were done. So that's history. But still, these are lessons that I think in computing we need to bear in mind all the time. Well, after about 15 years there, building systems and doing other exciting things, my next job was very different. I moved as a professor of computer science to the UK, to Warwick University, and this was a big change. I was at a university, not at a research institute. I was not in India, where I'd been working for all those years, and I had to learn a great deal. I had to learn about university teaching, about research networking, and of course, I had to learn how to survive in a competitive academic environment. So I learned to teach small classes, large classes. The very first lecture I gave to Warwick was on introductory programming, and there was a class of about 300 packed in a lecture room where there were even people sitting in the passages. I'm sure that was against all the fire regulations. And the crowd was not there to see the new professor of computer science, unfortunately. It was there because this introductory course was listed in far too many degree programs. So the ones at the back of this lecture theater could just about hear me, but could not read what I wrote on the board, unless it was in foot-high letters. And my carefully prepared slides could be seen by only the lower half of this mass of students. So that was a good introduction to teaching. And I learned. And the good thing is that it could only get better after that. So I made many mistakes. I made errors about the level that the students would have. I found that by the 80s, first-year students expected to be told what they would be taught and why. Then they were taught it. And finally, they had to be told what they had been taught. And then there had to be revisions. And examination questions were divided into parts with a credit for each part very clearly marked. No exploratory questions, and no questions that expected anything except one precisely defined answer. Now, I'm sure in terms of educational technology, that's very good. It means that marking and grading is very uniform. But in terms of challenging students to think beyond pure syllabuses, it's not a very good way to proceed. But perhaps it's too early in the early years of university education to do that. So I learned to be patient and to think about how a student would actually start to learn new material. And then over time, I learned that the first-year adolescent of 1 year became the questioning student of the next year and the mature and well-rounded adult of the third year. I also learned that students need a mentor, someone they can talk to very openly and frankly. So all this was an enormously educative experience for me. My research began to get a bit clearer. The use of formal techniques in real-time and fault-tolerant programming, which was later the title of a conference series I started at Warwick, which was full of interesting problems, and there were very few research groups working on them. So this meant that there was time to try out different solutions, and enough interested people at different universities across Europe and the United States to talk to. I learned to penetrate through what seemed to be impenetrable university committees. And I discovered that the people who were most successful in university committees were those who first made simple things sound extremely complicated and then allowed the others to congratulate them on finding a solution. So it is very important to mimic them to get anything done. And I learned one more new life skill. The last job I had before I retired was as the executive director of the TCS Research Center. And I was also an executive vice president in the company. So this is where I understood the need for speed. How if something can be done in 2 weeks, the challenge is to see if you can do it in one. Where it's sometimes worthwhile to fly across continents for a one-day meeting and get back home after that, and so on. But this was all the easy bit, the mechanical bit. The much more difficult lessons I learned were from teams involved with building extremely complex systems of the kind that you and I use every day, banking and insurance and everything else. The level of detail that these systems require to incorporate is truly amazing. Now, if you are trained as a scientist, science teaches you the importance of simplification, of removing unnecessary detail, and of focusing only on what is essential. That's how you solve problems. But practical systems need all sorts of complexities added because they have to deal with such a large variety of situations, and they have to keep running for a very, very long time. I think the most important lessons I learned in my last role were also in dealing with hundreds, sometimes thousands of people over whom one had some kind of responsibility. When is it important to be firm? How can you be sure that you're being fair? How do you look for the cases that need special attention, the person who really would benefit from a meeting with you, the person with whom a meeting would be of great value to you, and so on. The people I should really meet. The one reward I see today is that many of these people are still friends, and I can meet them, and I think there are people I can trust after all these years. So that's a quick summary of many years of work.
So it seems to me then, you know, you've had an opportunity to mentor quite a few people, either graduate students when you were teaching and into research at the university, but also through your consultancy work at Tata and in your research work at Tata as well.
Yes, I think that's a very important part of learning. When I was a graduate student, I had a wonderful supervisor who I met about twice a term. We used to bump into each other at tea and coffee quite often, but I met him formally twice a term, once at the beginning to tell him what I was going to do for the rest of the term, and once at the end to tell him what I had done. And I made no notes, and he made no notes. And at the end of a meeting with him, I would feel most relieved, but I was not quite sure exactly what he had told me. And it slowly unraveled itself over the course of the next few weeks or so, that what he said was very, very important. And I think it's such an important part of learning to be able to talk about things, to have other people talk about what you're doing, and to accept the odd nudge here and there saying, well, perhaps there's a slightly different way of doing things that might help you and might get you to the end a little faster.
Do you think that there's tension between the academic world and also then the, you know, the world of industry, and what would be ways to sort of resolve that tension, if there is, and build bridges?
I think this, I don't know whether calling attention is exactly the right word, but yes, there are differences in points of view. As I said, real academic computer scientists see the world in terms of problems that they have to solve to get the science to move ahead. And these problems have to be made as clean and simple as possible so that they can solve them as effectively as possible. People in the industry don't work that way. They have to build systems that need to be shipped out to people, and people will use these systems in all sorts of unexpected ways, and these systems have to keep working. So their lives are just filled with dealing with complexities, and when they think they're done, there's a fresh lot of complexities that they have to deal with, and that has to be incorporated in. So it's a never-ending process, and I think these are two very different points of view that people on either side find hard to understand, and is so important. The other, of course, is that there is a substantial difference in the pay scales, and underpaid academics sometimes are fairly resentful of the people they see as being overpaid people in the industry who do mundane jobs. Well, they don't do mundane jobs, but yes, they probably do get paid more. So yes, there are some tensions, as you put it, between them, but I think there's a great deal that they have in common too.
I guess there's the other aspect in the industry, in that you get into things like total cost of ownership and return on investment and aligning the technology side with the business objectives and business goals and so forth. And is that aspect, did you find that disruptive in terms of your thinking or aligned with your thinking? Because, you know, coming from both worlds, right? And both from the academic side and then merging that with the industry research and so on.
Yes, I think the thing that I found most difficult to understand initially was the fact that an industry runs not by what it decides to do, but by what its customers want. And its customers really are the most important thing. They are the reason why an industry exists. And you remove the customers, then that's the end. I found that very hard because it meant that the initiative for defining what one wanted to do was going to come from somewhere else. And that was a somewhere else I didn't really understand very well in the beginning. So I learned quite a lot there, and I learned what it is that customers might be looking for and how to find the underlying problems there and how very rewarding it would be if one could solve those problems through research. So yes, it was a change of point of view. In an academic world, you look at a subject, you get interested in something, you find a set of problems and you solve them, and the initiative is all yours. In the industrial world, you have customers, and these customers are the ones who keep your business going. And the customers have needs, and the customers have problems, and these are the ones you should be looking at. And of course, in research, you don't really address those problems directly, but you do need to keep in touch with customers so that you can find if there are any underlying weaknesses in the system, things that need a lot of research, that you can now focus on. Big difference, and very important, I think.
You know, you have such a long history of international successes and accomplishments. Which ones stand out for you as you reflect back?
I think that's a hard one. The things that matter most are the ones that gave me personal satisfaction. These are simple things like building a good system that people felt could not be constructed, writing a good paper, making a good friend, really fairly simple things that matter so much even after all these years. The rest drift away. They probably were important for a little time, but I don't think they matter very much now.
Are there any particular papers or different areas? I mean, you wrote a book in it as well. Are there those kinds of things that stand out in your mind, a particular paper that you did? Or
yes, and this is, of course, with hindsight. Many years ago, when I was working in the Research Institute in Bombay, a graduate student and I started looking at the problem of trying how to predict what the response time of a real-time system would be. And the problem was fairly well-defined, and a number of people had looked at it. And there were a few partial and very complex solutions that people had devised. But basically, people had put this aside. And it was a tantalizing and, if you like, an annoying problem, because it looked as if it should have a fairly simple solution. So we worked together and produced what he thought was quite a good solution, and wrote it up and sent it off, and the first journal rejected it, and the second one published it, and it lay there in the literature. And 5-10 years later, when I was in the UK, I discovered that people were inventing solutions for exactly that kind of problem, and there had actually been a solution published years ago. So I pointed this out to a few people, and they were quite surprised because they'd never read the paper. So I think, yes, it was great fun to write something that seemed small but important at the time, and which has much more significance later. I'd like to do that very often, but I've never had that pleasure. I have a friend and a former colleague who wrote a paper that he thinks is far from his best work and not very interesting, either theoretically or in practical terms. And that paper has over 2,500 citations today, and the number keeps growing. So we all have different points of view about the work that we do, and I think it's for the rest of the world of science to tell us what really is important.
You know, over your remarkable career, and again, looking over it from the sort of perspective going back, you know, what were the major change agents in your lifetime, and what can we learn from your experiences?
Well, I've lived most of my professional life here in India, by no means not all of it, but quite a lot of it. And this was an India that was changing enormously. In the beginning, when I was in school and perhaps in college, change was very slow, but it picked up pace, and now things are moving along very, very fast. So it's often the things around me that caused me to make changes in my career, and not really carefully thought out decisions based on careful evaluation. I don't know whether people really do work things out so precisely before they take a step forward or sideways. I certainly haven't. I would find the situation around me changed, and I need to do something about it. And I would think about that and then do whatever seemed to be the best option at the time. So perhaps most of my career changes came by accident and luck, and perhaps that is true for a lot of people.
I see. So it's something like outliers. You know, there is this sort of random events, perhaps, that influence where you go, or maybe you think it's fate, too, perhaps.
No, I don't think it's fate. Perhaps not even random events. For example, an economic situation changes. You decide that in your current job, you really can't do anything much more. You have to move, and you make a move. And you come into a totally new environment. And that stimulates you in all sorts of different ways. So I don't think that's random. I think it's these are events that are caused by changes around one. And they happen. And you can either ignore them or you can, you know, react to them and try and use the opportunity as constructively as possible.
I guess the key word there is treat them as opportunities. So as you have change agents external to your life, look at them as opportunities to gain new insights, wisdom, experiences, new skill sets, new learnings, and so on.
Yes, I think it's a very critical thing in the way I look at things. I tend not to look backwards at all. I tend not to ask myself, you know, how did I get here? What did I do right or wrong that got me here? And I spend almost all my time thinking about now that I'm here, what is the best thing that I can do next and how can I do it best? So looking forwards from wherever I am, and it's sometimes a bit uncomfortable and sometimes not that easy, but it's the way I think. My wife isn't like that. She tends to have a much more historical view of things and says, you know, it was what you did then that brought us here, good or bad. I tend not to think that way.
Can you highlight decisions that you've made now based upon hindsight that you would say, you know, I would do that differently today?
Yes. these are not frivolous examples, but they are non-computing examples. Let me go back many years. When I was in school, I started to learn to play the piano because that was the only instrument for which there were lessons at that school. But quite frankly, I was overawed by the teacher, and he was very soon exasperated with me. And after a few lessons, he decided, or perhaps we decided, that we'd both had enough. So the result was that I never learned to play the piano, and in fact, I've never learned to play any musical instrument. And that's a big regret to me today, because I love listening to music. I enjoy it. I would happily listen to it most of the time. But I cannot contribute in any way to it. I cannot even simulate it myself by trying to play an instrument. So it'll have to stay something that goes on in my head rather than something that I can physically participate in. That's one big regret. And I wish I had persisted or there had been an opportunity for me to learn some other instrument. Another example is that I would quite like to be able to speak a few more languages than I do. And there was an occasion when I was going to spend a few months in France in the 1970s. And I decided that I must learn some possible French. So I bought myself a set of French language books, recorded material, and slowly went through them lesson by lesson. I didn't get very far. So I took them with me to France. And on a tape recorder there, I used to play these lessons and listen to them. But once I was there, I realized that I could either spend my time learning French or I could get some work done. And it was very clear what I'd come there for, which was to get the work done. So I learned no more French, and in fact, no more of any foreign language. And today, as I travel here and there, I do regret not being able to speak at least one more foreign language quite fluently. So that's a big regret. And these are languages that are not nearly as hard to learn as, say, Chinese or Japanese, which I would greatly enjoy learning, but I think it's rather late in the day for me to try even. So there are many things like that that I felt, that I feel today I wish I had done, and I wish I had not let opportunities pass by. But as I said before, I tend not to look back too much. I've always found it very challenging to get to grips with a difficult situation and work my way through it. So I've concentrated on how I can make a reasonable job of what I have to do. And perhaps that's because I think too much about the how and too little about the what. And the what is, of course, very, very important. I tend to think more about the how.
But Ty, you know, you've been a global traveler and you worked in different parts of the world in very interesting positions, challenging positions where you gained a lot of insight. You know, again, from that perspective of sort of this world traveler and who's, when you sort of examine the ecosystem out there, what do you see as the top challenges facing us today and how do you propose they be solved?
Yeah, I assume you mean the challenges facing us as computing professionals. I think the first one is to make computers disappear from sight. They're altogether too much upfront and in your face. And this is what keeps ordinary people from using computing capabilities in simple and natural ways. I mean, if you really want to have a conversation stopper in a normal society, start talking to them about computing, and most people switch off completely. It's not something they want to think about. And yet, it's such a crucial part of everyone's life, and increasingly it's going to be important. So I think we need to learn how to push computers back out of sight. In some ways, the cell phone has done that. There's so many users of the cell phone spread out across nationalities, economic brackets, occupations, and people get comfortable with basic use of cell phones quite easily. They don't think about the fact that it's got a computer sitting inside, or perhaps more than one, and that there are computers running the switches and all sorts of other things that are needed to keep this communication system going. It's disappeared, and all they have is one device, and they press some buttons, and they can talk to somebody. So that's one way of looking at it. The other is to say, can we get even better than that? And I think devices like the iPod with its buttonless interface are showing us how you don't even need to have buttons. You could just stroke or pat or tap your choices into this gadget, and it responds and in a very natural-looking sort of way. And I think people will adapt to that also. So yes, I would like to see computers disappear completely from sight. The second big challenge is to be able to provide, through computing, levels of security and dependability that make our services as reliable as possible. I talked about cell phones and the communication network. How do we make that so reliable that it just disappears from sight? It's always there, and it's always going to work. How do we make our train systems so reliable that you can go to a station at the right time, the train will be there, you get on it, and with a remote possibility of any accident or any change happening along the way. So it to get them really reliable. Now, this is what things like computers really should be good at, and we haven't got far enough along that line. And I think much more needs to be done there. So perhaps you could call that the use of computers to help us to ensure that mechanical failures are anticipated and mitigated, and perhaps even are not even observed by the people around. The third interesting use that occurs to me, and there's a reason for it, which I will just come to, is that I wonder if we can use computers and interconnectivity to be able to provide a very true picture of public opinion and public choice. Voting for somebody once every 3 years or 4 years is one way of exercising a democratic choice, and it's certainly better than not having even that, but it's not sufficiently expressive in terms of what you think are the important issues of the day. So is it possible to be able to get public opinion expressed quickly and effectively over small issues and bigger issues locally and nationally over a period of time using computers and communication? And I think that's very, very important. The reason it comes to mind today is that the results of elections in some states in India are just being announced. Most of them have been announced. There's still a few to come. And the question that occurs to me is, how representative are these results of the long-term needs of the people who voted? Will they get what they're hoping for? And we should be able to get democracy to work at a much finer level than that today. So to make all this happen, all sorts of fields of computer science will face challenges. Building reliable software systems will need the use of mechanical techniques for requirement analysis and checking, automatic techniques for program generation and testing. There's a lot that needs to be done, and some work is being done today, but I think a new focus will emerge from this, and there's a big spread of areas that need to be looked at. In terms of democracy and all that goes with it, today we're looking at automating some parts of the process, but there's still a lot of doubts about whether things even as basic as electronic voting machines make sense. Now, in India, all voting is by electronic voting machines. These are not networked. These are standalone machines, and you go in and you have your choices laid out in front of you, and you press a button for the choice you make, and a buzzer goes off so that everyone knows that you have voted. And you leave. There's no paper trail, and my friends in North America tell me that that's a major flaw. But on the other hand, it is so much better than the paper system that we had earlier, which was very liable for errors, as well as corruption and so on. This eliminates a lot of that. But yes, true, I don't have a paper trail, so I have no evidence of who I voted for, and I have no, and there's no way of checking that this machine is actually doing the right job. But there are enough checks, I think, to show that it's a great deal better than it, than the situation before that. So can we move beyond all this? And can we have new levels of public participation? And there are many difficult problems here for people who work in distributed systems and in algorithms to look at. And I think they're very, very important problems. So those are, say, some of the challenges that I think we need to face today.
So what do you then see as the top research areas today, and what outcomes do you see in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, this may be really now from my background working in the industry that I see things coming from customers rather than things emerging on their own. So I think that the major new research areas of computer science will come from the extension of computing into new applications where the demands are very severe. So we talked about some of these earlier, like having ultra-reliable, ultra-dependable public transport systems, airlines, airports, communication systems, and so on. And we're some distance away from that today. And I think that's where the problems will start to emerge. And there will, of course, be interest in fundamental questions of things like whether P equals NP or not. And I'm sure that there will be interest in other such basic questions. But I think in terms of the bulk of computer science, the challenges will come from totally new problems that emerge as we press on with applications that should be giving people the kind of services that they need. And we will find new ways of having to solve these problems.
Do you see any sort of issues associated with cloud computing? And from an industry standpoint, it's a byword. It's got, you know, the idea is sort of penetrating many, many enterprises, even to the small businesses out there. In terms of security, storage, and other sort of areas, what are your views on cloud computing?
I think everyone likes to keep what they have and to sit on it and make sure it's secure. And the idea of letting your data go out into the wide ether is a bit worrying. Today, if I use a photograph service like Picasa or any other imaging service, I put my images up on that, there are many advantages. I can catalog them, I can label them, I can improve them in fairly simple ways. But there's the important question of who owns this data. And I would never part with the idea that I must own these. These are mine. I took them. It's not clear if I would still own them if they live only somewhere on a server, and I never see them in any other form except when I call them out again. So I think that question of ownership is very worrying for people. It's worrying for small businesses. It's worrying for big businesses who see a lot of competitive issues to do with this. So cloud computing has a lot of worries, but perhaps these are things that will get solved slowly, and people will be able to use cloud storages as much as they feel comfortable with, and the rest can sit with them. And then gradually, as they build up more confidence, perhaps more things will move there. Security is very, very critical. And the certainty that you control what other people see. And today, of course, that is a difficult challenge, because it's always going to be, you will always have to compete with the fact that there will be national bodies, there will be governments that will sometimes need to investigate things to be able to anticipate the kinds of problems that we see today here and there occurring. So what is the extent to which my privacy can be guaranteed, and what is the extent to which I must sacrifice it for the greater public good? These are difficult questions. So I think there are lots of things that we need to get used to with cloud computing, and I think the whole field has to adopt a learning view. Rather, we may not. Maybe cloud computing itself will start to change also.
Do you see any barriers or challenges? You know, I was talking to a gentleman from Intel, and he talked about, you know, as the number of cores increase, and potentially this is a serious area. Do you see sort of breakthroughs coming in that area to address that?
Well, I think we've all grown fairly complacent. When I say all of us who use processors and computers have grown fairly complacent that computing power will just keep improving, and storage will keep increasing in size, and costs will come down. And there's been no real change in that. People have been talking about multiprocessors for years and years. In the early 80s, people were talking about million-node computers, and the whole Japanese fifth generation, for example, was going to be a million-node computer that would have all sorts of intelligence properties. But that didn't really happen until technology developed to the stage where it was possible. Excuse me, where it was possible, and that has now begun to take shape. But more and more, I think, for people who are actually users, this may not make such a difference. It's just more computing power that's coming out of a box, rather than the worries about, you know, how multi-core is going to change things very substantially. It will for the people who are concerned with the insides, with people who write compilers, with people who have to optimize the scheduling of these machines. But I think it'll just be treated as one major performance boost, which can only be a good thing.
Do you see any major advances in machine learning?
Now, I'm not an expert in machine learning at all, but I think one of the things that will happen is that the use of natural language will spread much, much more. Even search engines now are becoming so much more easy to use because they are able to guess at what someone means with a query rather than take each word as an isolated atom and construct something out of it. So if I want to see what the weather's like in New York today and I misspell York, it makes almost no difference. I will get the weather for New York fairly unambiguously. So it doesn't even bother to say, do you actually mean New York or do you mean something else? It just gives me the weather for New York. And I think it's changes like that are important. But the use of natural language will spread. And the use of some amount of automated translation will also help. And that should spread. Going from Chinese into English or from English into Chinese, for example, is not going to be easy for anyone except an expert. But maybe some amount of automated translation can help, perhaps in restricted domains where the vocabulary is restricted and the semantics are restricted initially, but it will be so much more enriching for people, say, living in some part of India where the language is not widely spoken anywhere else, if they are able to understand what's happening in the rest of the world through automated translation. And people will adapt to poor translations, as long as it's not atrociously poor, they will understand that the machine has limitations, which is a good thing for them to understand. So, yes, I think that those are some of the things that might become important in terms of machine intelligence.
Now, can you tell us more about your vision and objectives behind your current role, and then what you hope to accomplish, and how you will bring this about?
Well, I would... being in the profession, I would like to see computing education spread widely among young people of all abilities and economic backgrounds, whether they're working in farms or the sons of rich people in cities, whatever they are doing, a proper understanding of computing education, not one that is restricted to the use of one set of tools or another set of techniques, but one that teaches them about basics of computing, the important basics of computing. It's interesting that you asked this question today because it's very recently, I think it's only in the last few days, that a resolution has been passed in the United States designating a week in December as Computer Science Week. And ACM has just sent out a press release about that. So it's fascinating that the United States, where a lot of this has happened and is happening, has in some way had to step back and say, we still need to be sure that people in this country see that computer science is important. We have to designate a whole week for computer science. We wouldn't say that today about you know, say the rights of women. We wouldn't have a week for the rights of women, because I think most people now take that for absolute granted, that women have as many rights as men, and there's absolutely no distinction between them. But the fact that today we need to say, we need to have a special computer science week to remind people just how much they need to learn and how important this is, tells us that we've still got a long way to go. This is the United States. How much more true that would be of countries like India or China or wherever else where things have been happening more slowly.
So I guess what you're also sort of aligning with or supporting is to try to address the, what's happening in some of the Western countries, and that is sort of this declining enrollments in schools up to 70% since 2002, and also driving sort of passion towards computing and computing science in the high schools, and even prior to that, to make it more, you know, to have greater diversity in terms of people embracing computing and computing challenges and problem solving and so on. And I take it you're sort of talking about those areas as well.
Yes. On the other hand, you know that there is no decline in enrollment in countries like India, and I suspect not even in China. So the decline in enrollment has happened in countries where there has been an economic stammer, and the situation has changed over the last year or 2 years. That has caused a lot of things. Also, the fact that the field of computing has changed very substantially, and the roles that people had defined for themselves earlier may no longer be viable roles today. When I was young, I thought being the pilot of a jet plane would be really as far as anybody could ever want to get. And there was certainly no spacecraft at that time. Today, I don't really feel great excitement at the possibility of piloting a jet plane. I'm happy to let someone else, who's probably much, much more competent than me, do it and do it well. So there is a change in perception that will come even for computing. The roles that people had seen for themselves in the United States were really as programming pioneers. And that situation has changed. I don't think there is that much left for the programming pioneer to do. It's become a well-established industry today. And when that happens, of course, it gets differentiated into what can be done most effectively and most cheaply, and where can this be done. So it does spread, just as manufacturing changed. I don't think people in the United States necessarily have great regrets at not making every nut and bolt that goes into a car that comes out of a factory here. And the fact that these nuts and bolts may be made in different parts of the world is not a matter of great distress. It's the way that the manufacturing industry has spread across the world. The same thing is true of computing too. So I think the decline here was a quick reaction to, in terms of perception rather than anything else. I think the role for computing in the United States is still very, very strong. It's that it's harder to be a computing cowboy anymore. I think you have to have a much more solid background and get your creativity into action in other ways.
You know, it's interesting. At the beginning of your response, you talked about China and India and the fact that you didn't go through a period of declining enrollments, and that's kind of interesting. And then I see this other figure that, you know, India graduates something like 400 to 450,000 engineers and scientists a year. And in China, it's over 700,000. But you contrast that to the U.S., which is about 60,000. I live in Canada, it's somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000. And, you know, the U.S. has, what, five, six times the population of Korea, and Korea graduates the same number, 60,000. So in terms of the Asia region, then, what are your insights and predictions for this region?
I think if everyone sees that Asia is beginning to stir, which is wonderful news. We are at the beginning of what should become a big upswing. It won't happen all at once, and it won't happen at the same time right across the continent, but I think it will happen in a way that spreads across the whole region. I don't really see the 21st century as the century of India or China or any other country, as people sometimes predict. I think I see it as a time when Asia gets the importance it deserves among the regions of the world, no more than other regions, but no less either. And I really hope that this century will also see the same thing happening in Africa, which has a much harder set of battles to fight before it will move up. But who's to say that that will not also happen in this century? That would be wonderful news. So I think Asia will slowly start to do what it should have done or could have done decades ago, and it'll do it across from east to west. And that can only be good news.
And I see news of a major bank moving from London and basing their headquarters now in Asia, because they are saying that that's really where the economic growth for the foreseeable future is going to be. I see this figure coming out of the IMF, and I believe they said something like the growth in China in 2010 will be 9%, in India it'll be 6.4%. And the U.S., they predicted something like 1.5 or 1.3%, and then the European Union about 0.3%. So again, you know, how do you see this whole economic shift impacting India and China and so on in the whole region, and sort of comparing that with what's happening in the West, and long term, what are the implications of all of that?
Well, I think these indicators, these indices are measuring change or rate of change. And of course it's going to be much faster in Asia, because there's so much further for them to go. It would be very wise to underestimate the enormous capacity that's just built into the whole system in the United States and in the West that is very substantial. That's not going to change. It may not grow as fast as it was growing earlier, but it continues to grow. Whereas what's happening is that countries in Asia are slowly beginning to come to the kind of economic situation that their citizens deserve, and it'll take a long time. Poverty in countries like India will not disappear in the next 20 years. It'll take a long time before that happens in a way that is really satisfactory for a country of that size. Whereas the United States lost those problems a long, long time ago. So whenever I see these indicators, I'm surprised that people underestimate the enormous built-in strengths of economies like the United States and Western Europe. They're very, very substantial. Yes, I mean, if people get over-adventurous, as happened a year or two ago, there will be disasters. But look how quickly things have pulled out of that, and how governments were able to work together to manage that whole situation. There was the Asian Tiger fall in the late 90s, and the effects of that on countries like Thailand and Malaysia and so on were very substantial. They changed those countries completely. I don't think that kind of effect will be felt from this one just as yet, but I think there will be some more reality coming into the situation. Maybe people were living above their means and were encouraged to do that, and so things will come back to a more realistic level. But I see just enormous strengths here, and I see the growth in the rest of the world, places like India, as being necessary just to get the population there to a level of self-sustainment that is absolutely critical, so that everyone has enough to eat, they have jobs, they have good health, they have reasonable public transport, and they're able to lead fairly rewarding lives. And that is what's going to stimulate growth there. You don't need that kind of growth here just now. And if it takes a little longer before the economy here picks up and grows, I don't think that's tragic. I think there's just so much strength built into this already.
You know, I see the results of a job migration task force and conducting a two-year study. And the study sort of indicates that to stay competitive in a global IT environment, industries and countries must adopt policies that foster innovation and improve their ability to attract, educate, retain the best IT talent, you know, the best computing talent. What solutions do you propose to address the issues raised when I talk about this?
Well, a lot of what we've been talking about today, Stephen, is related to increasing the capability and capacity in countries like India, because they just have so much to go, such a long way to go. But in terms of job migration, as I mentioned earlier, I think what we've seen so far is really a redefinition of the software and the IT industry. There are things that need to be done that can be done more cheaply somewhere else. It doesn't mean that new things cannot be done or that new things should not be done. I think it's enormous opportunity to do new things. Apple's iPod was designed very proudly, as they say, in the United States, not where the Apple iPod happens to be built, which probably is in one place, but could have been in 14 different places for all that matter. So in the same way, the software that's running the system that's supporting the ATM machine from which you draw out money, or the one that supports the credit card system from which you make payments, might be written in many different countries. And in future, I think will in fact be written in many different countries. But that doesn't alter the fact that there's an enormous role for the software industry in this country. I don't think the software industry in this country has actually shrunk. The figures I've seen suggest that it's growing, perhaps not as fast as it was some time back, but it is growing. So I don't think there's been job loss in that sense. But yes, there's been a redefinition. I know people have talked about people losing jobs, but I think that's more in terms of capabilities and new requirements. Overall, the number of people in the profession is going up. But yes, there are tragic stories of people who have lost their livelihood in that process, which is very, very painful. So I don't see that it's so much a question of job migration as a redefinition of the industry, which is happening, and which I don't think is finished yet. It will keep happening, and there will be different ways in which we can produce software, and different ways in which we can combine capabilities that exist in different parts of the world to build new software systems very effectively and quickly. And this will keep happening. So it needs to happen, because that's what's going to make this industry more efficient and capable of growing fast.
You know, you're in this very unique position with this perspective of both industry and research and teaching and all the different aspects that you've had in your very notable career. So it'd be interesting to get your perspective in terms of your predictions for the future and the implications and how we can best prepare.
Well, I think I'd like to go back to something I said in the beginning, which is that it's so important to make computers disappear. We don't really want to see them up front with keyboards and screens and nerdy people like me sitting in front of them, to the exclusion of ordinary people walking in the street or working in farms or whatever. So, and I think that'll happen once the devices and the services that can be produced using computing technology become much cleverer than they are today. So yes, I would like to see a basic cell phone that costs $20, because that would really spread computing across perhaps a very large part of the population of the world. And they wouldn't even know that. And it would give them capabilities that would change their lives, which people have seen already. I would like to see cheap laptops, but I suspect that maybe a $100 laptop, which still hasn't come. But I suspect that a basic cell phone is going to change things much more than perhaps even a laptop will. A laptop is really an educative device, and to have young children playing about with them and doing things would be great fun. But perhaps a laptop is not the only thing that will allow them to get this kind of computing background and computing learning. There may be other ways in which they can do it. People have experimented with other ways, with tortoises and block games and things that children can relate to easily, but which also illustrate the process of computation and how a series of steps can take you towards a goal. So there'll be many such things that happen. So a cell phone that costs $20, maybe a laptop that costs $100 and is properly internet connected. Ways in which ordinary people can use computers to relieve their lives. I think a cell phone would be build it up with too many things if you try to make it do everything that you would like. And today, to get a cell phone that is really good as a notepad and a dress book and a music player and of course as a cell phone, is still not really possible for any reasonable sum of money. So there's a great deal that can be done. I see things like biometric technologies developing a great deal in the future, so that perhaps we'll all get rid of locks and keys, traditional locks and keys, and all that will be needed is a physical device and a biometric check that will allow you to get into your house, and the same device will allow you to open your locked cupboard, because it'll know the difference between getting into your house and opening a locked cupboard. Change the way in which we think about security altogether. So it's that kind of change that I see happening and having really important effects, rather than wondering whether a processor will go from 16 to 32 core and what effect that might have. That's fascinating for us as computing people, but really irrelevant to the rest of the world. But if you could build a world without locks and keys, and just use biometric entry and to see your way through things, I think it would change the way we look at our lives. So that's what I would like to see. I can't list them all, but I think there are a number of such devices that will demonstrate our skills as computing people, because the machinery that's needed underneath that to make them work is what we will have to provide.
Hi, you know, you're one of the top researchers and senior academics and groundbreaking visionary innovators. Really, you've had an impact on the world, and your work will continue to shape what happens in the future. So how do you wish to continue to shape the world and contribute to the fabric of history?
Well, Stephen, I think all my life I've only thought in terms of very small steps. So I see what I need to do in front of me, and I try and choose between the ones I can do and the ones I cannot, and try and do these small things as well as I can. And I'm happy to leave it for history to tell us and tell others whether these steps made any difference at all. So I don't really have that kind of vision. I see what there is in front of me, and I try and work with it and say, well, how can we do this better than it's been done before? And that's always the challenge, and that keeps being the challenge even today. So that's perhaps a limitation that I have. I'm not one of those who sits back and is able to be a visionary.
Well, you've got just a remarkable background, so your work itself is visionary, in my opinion. You know, I have this opportunity, a very unique one, to drill into the accumulated wisdom from an accomplished executive and thought leader. And if you could sum up your life experience with tips about career and life, what would be your tips and the reasons behind them?
Well, I think I don't think I can do any better than to quote Steve Jobs when he said in his address to students at Stanford that the most important lesson he learned was that if you really want to do something, you must go ahead and do it. You have to be sure that you really want to do it, and then whatever it takes, and however long it may take, you must go ahead and do it. And that's the way he ran his life, and he's made a remarkable success of that. So I think if we could all keep that in mind, I wish somebody had told me that when I was young, and as clearly as that, that's very, very important. I don't think there's anything else one can give in terms of tips. There are opportunities, and there are difficulties, and if one constantly sees what one can do in this situation that is most effective and most rewarding, that's about as much as I would say.
Well, we're coming to the end of this interview, and I usually end with this question, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
My questions may well be the ones, Stephen, that you as an experienced interviewer will never ask. For example, the question I keep asking myself is, why should anyone consider your life to be interesting? And unless you can make that clear, why should anyone read what you've written or listen to a podcast in which you feature? So that's the kind of question that hovers above any of the answers that I gave earlier. And yet it's the kind of question that's never asked. So there are questions like that that occur to me. But beyond that, I think, you know, you've asked lots of questions. And I'm sure there are things that you haven't asked. But I think it's given me the opportunity to talk about many, many things, things that I haven't really thought about for many years. So it's been a wonderful opportunity for me, too.
Well, Matthai, with your demanding schedule, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview. Thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a great opportunity, and I hope a few people will begin to listen to this, and if they're interested, I'd be very happy to be in touch with them. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with the eminent Dr. Matthai Joseph, internationally renowned executive, researcher, and technology advisor, distinguished computer